Many cities have Derma bookshops. I even think that in Auckland here at one time you had a Derma restaurant. Is that right? But I do wonder how many people in the Western world really understand the meaning of this word. Perhaps I should say the meanings, because there are many meanings. Now, it's adopted from a Sanskrit word. Dharma is a Sanskrit word, and it has actually been adopted by the Western world. And when I was preparing this lecture, I looked up some dictionaries. Webster's was one, and it gave, in 1962, it gave a definition of dharma as conformity with the law, duty, virtue, and in another dictionary, it had the word righteousness. But to my mind, the true meaning of dharma is expressed in this quotation from Hamlet, which you all probably know. To thine own self be true, and it shall follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man. To thine own self be true. A definition like this, does it imply duty? It certainly has in it the word true and implies the concept of truth. And this is leading us on to a greater idea of the whole subject, because truth is a grand concept. Now, in the little book that some of you may know, it's available in the Theosophical Library, At the Feet of the Master, the whole idea is put in very simple Western language. Be true in action. Never pretend to be other than you are. For all pretense is a hindrance to the pure light of truth, which should shine through you as sunlight shines through clear glass. So this concept of truth is equivalent to dharma. And some of you may know that in the Theosophical Seal, there is written at the bottom, there is no religion higher than truth. And that the Sanskrit word from which truth was translated is dharma. I think it's correct to say, from a philosophical point of view, that which is absolute, a concept of God, cannot have attributes. But just to contradict that statement, I'm going to suggest that if God, or your concept of divinity, or oneness, or unity, had attributes, the first would be unity, and the second would probably be truth. So we find that truth gives us a concept of that which we can consider to be the one, the supreme, the God, if you like. And then we find that truth is easily translated or interpreted as law or righteousness. I don't like this word very well. It's been twisted in its meaning today. Perhaps we should say essential rightness. Rightness is a better word than righteousness from the point of view that I'm trying to put forward tonight. Now, if we accept the fundamental theosophical concept that in his highest aspect, in his spiritual consciousness, man is one with the divine nature, that he is a spark of the divine fire, then we have established some sort of link between the varied meanings given of the word dharma. One of our writers, whose book is on the table here, Annie Besant, has written in that book what she calls a definition of dharma. And the definition that she gives is the essential nature of a thing, that which makes it what it is externally, that which makes it to be what it is externally, hence the laws of its being, and that implies the concept of duty. And she adds, and it includes religious rites appropriate to those laws and customs, and also righteousness, or as I said, rightness. I myself feel drawn to this definition, the essential nature of a thing, and following from that, the laws of its being. But the usual interpretation of dharma is duty. And because of this, I think we should have a look at this meaning, which is commonly accepted in the Western world, and yet which, to me, seems to be farthest from the real meaning. Now, this concept of dharma as duty comes from the caste system in India, which in its original purity had the intention of directing the life of each man and woman into a lifestyle best suited for his or her abilities. In the Bhagavad Gita, which you know is one of the very well-known Hindu scriptures, it is put this way. The four castes were created by me according to the varied distribution of excellences and karmas. Karmas, in that case, being the cumulative result of past action. But in this caste system, who was to do the allocating as far as the individual was concerned? Now, it's probable that in the very early days, the Brahmins, the priest rulers, had the ability to recognize to which class each child belonged. But the system was wide open to abuse, and it suited the ruling Brahmins to gradually enforce the law that each belonged to the class into which he or she was born. This ensured that only the sons of Brahmins became Brahmins. No others could enter the exclusive ruling caste, no matter how suited they were by ability or temperament. To enforce the caste system, the Brahmins stressed that to work according to class was the duty, and here you have the word, was the duty of each person. And so dharma was linked with duty. And this inadequate interpretation is still with us, still used by theosophists and other students of Eastern religions. Who should know? Really, if they went on their studies, they should know better. If we have a duty at all, it is to our spiritual nature, our true self, and not to a caste system. Now, the Lord Buddha was born a Hindu and gave his message to Hindus in northern India. And he pointed out the evils of the caste system. Just a small quotation. A man does not become a Brahmana by his plaited hair, by his family, or by his birth. But the Brahmins were loath to part with the authority to which they had unlawfully succeeded, and in the course of time, they re-established their power, and it was Buddhism that was swept out of the land of its birth. Fascinating, the story of this. Out of India, into Burma, Ceylon, Indonesia, into Tibet, China, and even Japan. Now, if we look at the southern Buddhism, the Theravada, we find that the word dharma is spelt a little differently. It's D-H-A-M-M-A in English transliteration, because it comes from the Pali rather than the Sanskrit. And its meaning is extended beyond the definition almost, which I have given you, although the first definition, you remember, was quite a wide one. It was extended to encompass the whole teachings of the Buddha, the Buddhist religion in its entirety. For the Buddha, Dharma, or righteousness, is the driving principle in the universe. It is the only reality of which we can be certain. The redemption or salvation of the world is the actualization of Dharma. So it becomes the law of deliverance. Deliverance from what? Well, perhaps we better go on before I answer that. Whether the Buddha arise or not, the Dharma exists. When he does arise, that is, when he does come into incarnation, it is a Buddha who realizes and expounds this Dharma, which has always been hidden from the ignorant, and he only reveals it when he comes as an enlightened one and compassionately reveals it to the world. So the Buddhist scheme proclaims the ultimate salvation of all beings through insight into the Dharma, which brings ultimately enlightenment. But the Theravada made it clear that Dhamma is not something apart from oneself, but is closely associated with oneself. And the Buddha says, abide with oneself as an island, with oneself as a refuge. Abide with the Dhamma as an island and with the Dhamma as a refuge. Seek not for external refuge. The refuge is within ourselves. So Dhamma, to the Southern Buddhist, is the basis of the ethical signpost, which you all know, or most of you will know about, the Noble Eightfold Path. Behind that stands the law of Dhamma. Now to the Northern Buddhist, who lives by Mahayana Buddhism of Tibet, the meaning of Dhamma is essentially the same, although it retains more of the original Hindu meaning. In both schools, Dhamma is the law which exists in a man's own heart and mind, in his conscience, if you like. Buddha appealed to man to be noble, to be pure, to be charitable, to be tender, not in order to please any god, but in order to be at peace with himself. So they, the Buddhists, like the Hindus, tacitly accept the idea that the principle of goodness and holiness which resides in a man's inmost self is his essential nature, and his essential nature was our primary definition of Dharma. But the Buddhist extends his concept of Dharma to the macrocosm as well as to man, the microcosm. The whole universe to him is an embodiment or revelation of Dharma. The laws of nature reveal Dharma. The sun rises and sets in an ordered rhythm, and all nature reveals an intelligent and beneficent control and a potential perfection in its essence. You know that the tree, if the conditions are correct, will grow to an essential perfection which is belongs to that particular type of tree. But often, or near always almost, it cannot achieve that perception because prevailing winds, poor soil, lack of water, or something or other causes it to fail to reach that archetypal perfection. The Buddhist Dharma is also the principle of righteousness, which is the basis of morality. And this is expounded by the Dalai Lama of Tibet, or the exiled Dalai Lama of Tibet, in his book, The Opening of the Wisdom Eye. And, of course, this is from the point of view, again, of the Mahayana, the Buddhism of Tibet. I've borrowed from his ideas, but I'm not quoting them exactly because I've condensed them somewhat. The root meaning of Dharma is to protect or to uphold. Dharma is therefore one's efforts when one tries to live in accordance with the law. Our highest duty as human beings is to search out a means whereby we may be freed from all kinds of suffering and unsatisfactory experiences. The phrases are the Dalai Lama's. By finding the root causes of such experiences and then destroying them, human life can become happy, or I would like to put the word in, purposeful. In order to achieve this, it is necessary for us to cooperate in our lives with those causes producing happiness and to cease to act from causes giving rise to suffering. The Dharma of the Lord Buddha shows the way to do this. The painful experiences in life should be realized as simply the natural content of that wandering on process of life. And, life and death, which is our everyday existence. Samsara, it's called. That wandering on effect of life and death. All feelings experienced, whether pleasurable or painful, arise from causes, and they do not arise unless there is a cause. The quintessence of the Dharma is the understanding that each man is responsible for the pleasurable and the unpleasant feelings experienced by himself because these are the fruits of his own actions in the past. The Dalai Lama put it this way, past intentional evil actions. So all works according to the karmic law. Everything is governed by this law, which we'll talk about later. The law of cause and effect. As we sow, so shall we also reap. According to the Dalai Lama, the method of negating bad or unskilled action, or action results is probably a better word, is known as Dharma righteousness. The Dalai Lama, in common with other Buddhist teachers, stresses that feelings of pleasure or unpleasure, that's pain, can be subdued by mental processes reinforced by will. So the progressive training of the mind and its development, what the Dalai Lama calls molding the mind, is also called Dharma. When Dharma is considered as religion or religious way of living, then its function is to serve as a protector or source of refuge. Remember, the root meaning of the word was to protect or to hold. And what are we protecting ourselves from? Well, I'm answering the question now. In a way, we're really protecting ourselves from ourselves. That which is spiritual in ourselves, from that which is not spiritual, that which belongs to our personality and all its weaknesses. And this perhaps helps us to understand the Buddhist affirmation. I take my refuge in the law. The law is Dharma. This may sound a negative way of looking at Dharma, but for the Buddhist, it leads to the realization and the practice of serenity, discipline, joyous detachment and self-restraint, and shelters them from the tumults of human life and from the suffering, while at the same time it leads them towards the ultimate goal of enlightenment. Now, let's have a look at the concept from the Hindu point of view. Dr. Annie Besant, to whom I referred earlier, expressed the view that each civilization had a peculiar word from the eternal, a word which was unique, which sounded a unique note, in the world. And she suggested that in ancient Egypt, this word was religion. In Persia, ancient Persia, it was purity. In ancient Chaldea, it was science. In ancient Greece, it was beauty. And in Rome, it was law. But in India, it was Dharma. And India is the firstborn, as she says, of the Aryan races. It is the cradle of the Indo-European civilization. And so Dharma lies at the very basis of the Aryan history. From the days when the Vedic teachings were given to India by the rishis, those great teacher, divine teacher rulers, the concept of Dharma has been put forward as the essential spiritual nature, both of man, the microcosm, and of the universe, the macrocosm. And of course, as I said earlier, because man is a spark of the divine fire, the essential nature of both is at its ultimate source, or at its highest level, the same. We cannot complete a study of the subject of Dharma without some explanation of the Hindu concept of this basic unity in terms of creative sound or vibration. And this part of my talk may be a little bit more difficult to follow, but I think to some of you it will be interesting. The ultimate mystery behind the manifested world of appearances as we know it is this question of sound or vibration, creative sound. A theosophical writer, Dr. R.K. Timni, explains this concept in relation to Dharma. According to occultism, there is a mysterious integrated state of vibration from which all possible kinds of vibration can be derived by a process of differentiation. I haven't got my chart here, but if you take a white light, a beam of white light, and pass it through a glass prism, that white light is broken up into the colors of the rainbow, and they merge one into another. Not clear, the divisions are not clear-cut. They merge one into the other. Red fuses into yellow through orange, and so on. You've probably seen this happen. And in that rainbow, there is an infinite number of gradations of color. And each of those has its own particular note or vibratory rate. And so we've got something the same idea in this that I'm talking about. Because this integrated state, like a white light, is called in Sanskrit the nada. And the medium of these vibrations is called akasha, in which is an infinite amount of potential energy which can find expression in all the vibrations needed in the manifested world. And vibrations produce forms, creative sound by, if you put filings on a diaphragm, drum diaphragm, and sound a note or sing a pure note with a human voice, those filings, the sand, will form patterns. Some of you may have seen this done. This is bringing us back to the concept, the biblical concept. In the beginning was the Word, because the Word in that sense is the creative sound. So at the back of or hidden in Akasha is divine consciousness or intelligence, which alone can produce out of itself any amount of energy. So the different kinds of vibrations taking place in this world, and at superphysical levels as well as in this world that we know, are the differentiated forms of nada, the super-integrated vibration in Akasha, which is essentially mental in nature. Perhaps it's like a giant computer. In that computer are all the basic vibratory sounds, or the vibratory sounds which produce all forms. This one primary vibration is stored in the computer, and it can be brought forth, according to the need, in all the forms, or all the rates of vibrations which we find in the manifested world, and everything is a variation in the rate of vibration. A short while ago, I was shown a slice across a mammoth tusk, which came from Alaska. And this gave me the most amazing sort of feeling when I looked at it. That tusk is at least 5,000 years old, possibly 10,000 years old, because, of course, the animal had been buried in the ice. But it was cut just across about an inch thick and about 6 inches in diameter. And there it was, really still almost as it was when the animal was alive. And this going back in 5,000, 10,000 years had a tremendous effect upon me, because it makes us realize that time and space, these gradations of time and space, lineal time and space, as it is sometimes called these days, has stopped us expanding into a much wider concept. Now, in our minds, the perception of sensation by the sense organs is based on these differentiated vibrations from this integrated source, and the properties of the objects we see, touch, or smell are also related to these vibrations mathematically. And in the Indian philosophy, Prakriti, or root matter, is the principle which brings this relationship about. And Prakriti is called in this context Dharmi, D-H-A-R-M-I, the potential container of all properties. And the word Dharma is used for the properties of matter, the properties of anything. So here we have the primary meaning of Dharma. It is the unique vibratory quality of any object in the manifested world, which gives that object its properties or its quality. And we know something about this today. We've coined the word in the last 20 years, vibes, which means, of course, vibrations. And your assumption such has good vibes, has bad vibes, has so-and-so. Can you feel the vibes? Well, these vibes, of course, are the lowest manifestation of the dharma of a thing. They may be very imperfect, but they still represent that latent perfection in the thing itself. They represent its unique quality. In man, of course, this vibratory quality springs from that which is called in theosophical literature the monad, the one, the highest aspect of his consciousness, which as a fragment of the one, the divine reality, is sounding its unique note within the whole. In each of us, this note sounds out our potential perfection, the enlightened or perfect being which we will become in terms of the evolutionary process. Or, more accurately, the perfect being which we are now, but which we do not realize because of the self-made limitations which crowd in on us in these lower worlds of existence. If that is so, we can attain enlightenment at any time whatsoever. And I think, possibly in theory, this is right. It's been said by many great teachers. The transcendental or spiritual self, the reincarnating individuality, can respond to that vibration or creative sound, which is its latent perfection. But when we pass in consciousness from the transcendental self into the thought-feeling activity of the personality, the response is very incomplete, for the note of our true essential nature is drowned in the vortex of everyday existence. It is then that the troubles of life as we know it begin, and as the Buddhist made so clear, it is Dharma, the law, which can lead us back to our true spirituality. So Dharma can be understood as our uniqueness expressed as vibration or sound, our potential perfection, which is a small but significantly important contribution to the realization of the perfection of the whole, which is, of course, the aim of the evolutionary process. Not only the evolution of the form, but the evolution of this of the spirit, the life that uses the form. Dr. Timely goes on to say, function is the manner in which a thing works or gives expression to its essential nature. Tat, or that, is the divine reality, And the function of that divine reality is tattva, which has the same meaning as dharma, but refers to the divine function, whereas dharma is used to express the essential qualities of ordinary things. Man is included in those ordinary things. Both are dual in that they have static and dynamic aspects. The properties and functions of anything in nature will be seen to be the static and the dynamic aspects. When you look at a thing, you often look at it as static, that which is, just that which distinguishes it from other things, and you get an idea of what the thing is then. But if you see the thing fulfilling its function in life, acting according to the laws of its being, then you look at it from a slightly different way. But there is no doubt that the word dharma in Sanskrit covers both these aspects, the essential nature of anything, properties as well as functions, the thing static and the thing in activity. In the definition quoted at the beginning of this talk, dharma is explained as that which makes a thing or a person to be what it is externally. The external appearance is the result of the less visible inner forces. So dharma is that which drives us towards the expression of our ideal natures. It is a self-imposed duty based on the laws of one's own being. Even if we are aware of this as a drive, we often react against it. But mostly, of course, we're not aware of the drive which comes from our true archetypal nature. So dharma, from this point of view, can be seen as the blueprint of our future perfection, towards which we are drawn inevitably. As we act in life in conformity with our essential nature, the laws of our being, the limitations placed upon the personality are lessened. There is a release from the bondage of physical existence, the wheel of births and deaths, as it is called. We gradually become less conditioned, to use a Western expression. We become less conditioned by the physical or material world and more conditioned by our spiritual nature. Dharma is therefore the law of unfolding, which molds the outer life in the image of the inner, the transcendental. Now, we can't really complete the study of dharma without understanding its twin law, which is karma. Karma is the law of cause and effect. Karma can be looked upon as action, and looked upon action as the effect you get with a pendulum. I have my pendulum with me tonight, so I'll try and show you what I mean. If you have a pendulum here, if I do it here for beginning, if we stand it on there, that's a perfectly vertical line. You lift it off there and it's still fairly steady. Now when that is steady, this represents, I'm going to suggest, the dharma, the essential nature of a thing, all the qualities. But in life, this is what actually happens. We are free, we have self-consciousness, and we act, and we push this off of the vertical. And when we do, it swings back, and it goes on swinging. But what we do, we don't let it slow down, we give it another tap, we react, and it swings more violently. Ultimately, it will swing less and less until it comes back to the vertical again, which is the essential nature. Everyone getting it? So this law of swinging is the law of karma. As it swings out of the vertical, then there is a force which brings it back, which adjusts it to the point of balance, the point of balance being the vertical. And if we apply this to life of an individual person, the point of balance can be likened to the individual dharma. When the pendulum is moved by conscious action out of the state of balance with the perpendicular, it returns to the perpendicular, but it carries its swing on the opposite side and goes on. But whenever it is in the perfectly vertical position, it is in line, in harmony with its own true inner nature. And when this happens, we are achieving what I'm going to suggest is karma-less action. Action according to the laws of our being, or dharma, action which does not produce reaction. And that is the true nature of our highest aspect. Dharma can therefore be looked upon as a straight line from the monad, the divine spark, through the transcendental self, or reincarnating individuality, where the law of karma does not act, or at least it doesn't act as we know it in this world here, right down to our own personality in the physical body, where karma, as a law, most definitely does act. This dharma, being our monadic archetypal perfection, is with us always, in this life, in the next life, and so on. In incarnation in this world or in the after-death states of consciousness between lives. That dharma is with us all the time. It is always a direct vertical line and represents a pressure to unfold or evolve according to the innate perfection which is our true nature. However far we stray at the personality level, that dharma will bring us back and pressurize us to conform, for it is the law of our being, it is our essential nature. When our actions at the personality level are not in conformity with the archetypal perfection, which is our true spiritual nature, the law of karma causes a reaction, which is an adjustment towards the point of balance where we are in harmony with our dharma. And that is, I can't make it swing. And that is, now I'll try and put this in a diagrammatic form. It won't take a moment. Some of you will have a concept of a theosophical concept, but I'll just put here that we have up here the monad. Or the spiritual nature, the highest spiritual nature of man. We then have another, which we will call here the transcendental self, or if you like, it's shorter to write, the higher self.
Mr. Patterson is now drawing his sketch on the blackboard.
And here we have the personality of thought and feeling. Now, down here we have the physical. Now, if we put down here, perhaps I'll do the personality. I'll put it down here. It makes it easier. Now, if we have this vertical line that I was talking about, that powerful line, which is our true essential nature, then it's a drive upwards towards this point here where it's achieved, if you like, where it becomes one with the all-embracing unity. But this drive upwards is working all the time. But at this point here, the law of karma comes into effect. Now, this is the pendulum, as we saw. And that pendulum swings. Are you with me? So what happens is, actually, within the personality of thought and feeling, we have this perfection of the archetypal nature, the dharma, that we tip it out of balance, and the law of karma brings it back, and it swings to the other side, and it goes on, probably getting less and less. See what I mean? Now we've got two laws acting here. We've got the law which is personal, which belongs to us only, which is the law of our essential nature. And that is working all the time as a drive towards the achievement of that latent perfection. And we have a law of adjustment, a law that forces us back to the balance. The balance always being Dharma. Is that clear? So one is a vertical law, the other is a horizontal law. One is a drive that has one direction only and it's there all the time. The other is an adjustment back to a point of balance. This is a universal law, that is a personal law. I'll go back to my notes, I think I can summarize it for you. I don't get this tangled up. Karma comes into play when we sin, or if you like, when we act contrary to the perfection which we will someday express. When we do achieve this full expression of our true individuality, our spiritual nature, we will be liberated and will be in a state of consciousness where there is no duality and which places us beyond the action of karma. Our consciousness is up in the higher levels here. We will then be free of the cycle of existence, the wheel of births and deaths. But theosophists and others who have studied the subject of karma, there are many in the world today, as well as them, accepting the fundamental truth of this law and making it into a doctrine. It is talked and written about freely today, but there is a need to realize exactly what it is, as there is a need to realize the difference between it and Dharma. When you think about it, you will see that this law deals with action and reaction only. It is a mechanical, in terms of our diagram, it acts horizontally, or almost horizontally. Karma, as the mechanics of adjustments, is an impersonal law like gravity and affects all self-conscious beings in an equal measure. It is the individual who acts so as to create a great stir or to maintain harmony with his surroundings. He acts, and the law of karma adjusts that action towards a balance, which is in accordance with the other, and I think the more important law, the essential nature of the individual, which is his Dharma. So I think it's true to say that Dharma is the law which is all important to the individual because it is his blueprint of perfection. And this is probably why H.P. Blavatsky said in her glossary that Dharma is the sacred law, because it is the law of man's unfoldment. Annie Besant also has a definition which helps us put this in its right personal context. Dharma may be defined as the inner nature of a thing at any given stage of evolution, and the law of the next stage of its unfolding. Carrying on the quotation, I must know the stage of my growth, and I must know the law which will enable me to grow farther. Then I know my Dharma, and by following that Dharma, I am going towards perfection. Each of us has his own note to sound, his own inner duty, which is to live according to that note, which is his Dharma. So we should try to be aware of that uniqueness in ourselves, which is our Dharma, and to develop it in as many ways as we possibly can. Decide what action, what aims in life truly fit in with your uniqueness, and consciously attempt to bring them more and more into your life. To do this, we must know our Dharma. And this is not very easy, but we can get indications sometimes, if we look at and watch ourselves and what we do, as to that which we feel is our true essential nature. And the important thing is to remember that the Dharma of every one of our fellow men is different from our own. All men mirror a different portion of the perfection, which is the divine mind, and each is moving towards his different perfection, his unique perfection. You can't know the Dharma of another. So let him go his way and you go yours. You have no real criteria with which to judge the way he goes about following his Dharma. You really haven't. So let him go his way. If this is truly understood, there could be no rivalry, no competition, no jealousy between men. And from the true occult point of view, as he moves forward according to his Dharma, so is your unfolding quickened. No personality in the limitations of physical existence can fully express the nature of the divine reality. Each one is making a contribution. So as each one becomes more and more perfect and unfolds according to his Dharma, the combined effect of such growth by the many may partly reveal the reality of the one which is all. Each one is moving towards his different perfection according to his Dharma, and each has a unique contribution to make to the whole. And today there's so much talk about holism, and this is one of the ways of understanding the inner nature of the unity of all and the part that each part, that each as a fragment, plays towards the achievement of the whole. Thus, the perfection of the world, the solar system, or even the universe, is the perfection of multiplicity, the perfection of its countless differentiated parts, which at the same time is their integration back into the wholeness, which is the one without a second.